the thought forms or emotion forms was with vibration, that they themselves represented a kind of vibration, that they could only be reached by a vibration, that as vibration sustained them in the form of the neurotic emotion of the owner, so antipathetical vibrations could destroy them. So he entered into a strange world of invisible warfare between vibratory forces. And his only guide for a long time was his study of planetary motion. Later he added to that a considerable knowledge of magnets, of lodestone, and particularly of the early, not the present form, but the early element, which was known as electrum. He caused rings and other devices to be composed of various elements. And on some cases, he was able, he felt, to draw poisons out of the individual. He also believed that the thought forms and emotion forms that had attached themselves to persons as parasites could be transferred, that there was a possibility of a psychic surgery for their removal. If, however, they were simply bombarded, as soon as the bombardment was over, these forms would return, even though battered and shaken, and continue to derive whatever life they could from the previous owner. But Paracelsus discovered that these parasites, by what he called sympathetic medicine, could be transplanted to creatures that they did not hurt, and that thought and emotion forms destructive to man, for example, were harmless to vegetation. This was a rather complicated procedure, and in one of the other discussions on sympathetic therapies, we will go into it. But a very large part of his medicine, as he himself tells us, his medical practice, was his effort to do the one thing which he felt to be most necessary, namely, to treat in some way the invisible part of man. In other words, your visible part, by the time the ailment got there, you were just on the border of being too late. The trouble was not only well underway, but due to the natural thoughtlessness and indifference of people, they did not even approach the physician when symptoms first appeared. They usually waited much too long. By the time Paracelsus or any other physician inherited the patient, the ailment was in an advanced stage. Paracelsus, looking over such incurable ailments as diabetes, that is in his day, tuberculosis, arthritis, and things of that nature, was convinced that the true therapy for them would have to be found in treating their cause, and that their cause was not purely physical. Certainly it could be aggravated by physical circumstances, and Paracelsus was very conscious of hygiene, diet, and the use of mineral baths, and things of that nature. But he was convinced primarily that most ailments of the human body arose in the invisible network of factors behind the personality itself, behind the corporeal structure. He did not believe that the elementals, as nature spirits, had too much to do with this. He did not believe them to be more than mischievous, perhaps spiteful, certainly not essentially malicious. But he also declared that these beings would fight when their elements were disturbed. That's an individual who, through his activities or functions, disturbed the liquid distribution in his body, or disturbed the physical element, or the airy principle, or the fiery principle. When he misused these, or disturbed their harmony, or failed to maintain their law and order, then the elementals came into the picture. In the effort to defend and reorganize and restore their own elements, whatever these elements might be. On the other hand, the elementaries, or the man-created creatures, had only one essential motive, and that was the motive of the emotion that created them. If hate created them, they hated completely. But they were bound only to the person whose hate had created them. Contrary to his general opinion on the subject, Paracelsus did not believe that you could hate someone and that this elementary you created would then go out and hurt the person you hate. He did not believe that at all, because he declared that this elementary could not exist except in the direct presence of your own energy field. Therefore, it could never leave you, and the hate which you had bestowed upon it could only return to you. Paracelsus believed that hate, for example, having projected itself as a vibratory rate from the human being, been captured in some form of a complex entity, in the form of a fixation or neurosis or whatever we want to call it, but captured in the form of an entity, that this entity gradually strengthened and continued to grow upon that hate. And whenever that person hated again, that was food for this thing. And every exhibition of hate, every impulse, every instinct, every emotion or feeling of hatred that the person allowed to rise within himself immediately became a nourishment to this entity. This entity then began to radiate its own force. And this force turned back upon the person as a form of chemical hate, and began to destroy the harmony and equilibrium of the various functions of the body. Paracelsus had another theory, which perhaps would seem very ridiculous to us, and yet we have never solved it satisfactorily even to the present time. Namely, that what we call the germ is a man-made living thing. That bacterial organisms, viruses, and all these other mysterious microforms of life that are so minute that we can hardly distinguish them, that these are created by man. And he declared, that epidemical disease would always parallel or follow epidemical outbreaks of human intensity. That war, for example, would nearly always end in a plague. Not necessarily would this plague be limited to the stricken area, but that an entire group of energy units projected by human consciousness in the form of evil would become microorganisms and would turn back upon man himself, that by polluting the psychic field of his world, he destroyed his own power to live. And that mankind, therefore, was constantly suffering from what we would term smog. In this case, not the physical kind, which is probably due to uncontrollable avarice on the part of certain individuals who will not make proper arrangements to protect the air for their fellow creatures, but that there is a psychic smog. And that this is due to the tremendous discharge of negative emotional mental units of energy. And that these units of energy infecting space create a common toxin. These energies do not necessarily transmit themselves to anyone. In other words, these collective hates do not cause the individual to hate, necessarily, who does not normally have the inclination. Nor does this ailment necessarily fall upon the individual as in the nature of active entity obsession. It falls upon him principally in toxic quality. The hate which is not his own affects him toxically. It is not necessarily going to attach itself to him as an entity. But it does corrupt the substances from which his nutrition is derived. And wherever the psychic field of humanity collectively is disturbed, you will have a further expression of poor health, disease, sickness, and things of that nature. Paracelsus believes, therefore, that the ultimate end of the problem of health lay in the same manner as the solution of other primaries, namely that only the wise and the good and the happy person can be well, that there is no other answer, and that sickness in the individual is due to some imbalance in himself. Now, Paracelsus himself was sick, and so is everyone else. He knew this. He realized that under the conditions in which human beings live, complete freedom from sickness is almost impossible. The conditions arising in society, the collective attitudes of mankind, we cannot completely resist, nor can we protect ourselves against every subterfuge against our health which is practiced around us. But Paracelsus believed we could greatly minimize our vulnerability through the reintegration of our own natures, and that what we might term defensive vitality is derived from the fact that our own psychic nature is free from elementaries, free from parasitical attitudes which are constantly draining our vital resources. Now, in the early editions of his works and some others, we have man's negative emotion, mental life, represented surrounding him as a cloud of devil-like insects. He is moving in a cloud filled with the most horrible little monsters. These represent his own attitudes, which become poisonous to us, and from which he cannot escape. There is no remedy, because he can go anywhere, he can be with anyone, he can have much or little, yet his mental, emotional habits can still pursue him unless he changes them. He can never escape from their consequences. Paracelsus, therefore, was a sort of minister of goodwill among men. He believed definitely in the importance of man establishing a relationship of goodwill to the intelligent universe around him. That only when man was thoughtful of the world would the world protect him. That only when he himself labored for the common good would the common good labor for him. That a partnership had to be set up between man and nature, and between visible and invisible, in the compound constitution of the human being. That if he had certain attitudes strong within himself, the elementals might reveal to him the treasures of the earth, and the elementary certainly would not bother him. If, however, they had already come into existence, and he was beginning to feel the various deprivations of energy which result from thought and emotion forms draining vitality, then it was up to him to take the necessary steps to cut off or to remove these malicious factors. He pointed out that everything survives only on nutrition suitable to itself. That nothing can survive on a nutrition which is unsuitable. Evil cannot survive on good. Happiness cannot survive if fed misery continuously. Misery, on the other hand, cannot continue if it is fed happiness. All fixation and complexes, or elementaries as he called them, in order to survive, grow, and become strong and powerful, must be continually nourished. Therefore, the first remedial process that man can employ is to stop nourishing those conditions which are destroying him. He knows what they are, because he knows, basically, whether his attitudes are constructive or destructive. Unless he is subnormal mentally, he is certainly aware when he is kind or unkind. He is aware when he is suspicious or trusting, when he is selfish or unselfish. And it is because that he is aware of this instinctively that he is continually attempting to conceal the undesirable phases of his own nature. If he did not recognize them and did not know they were undesirable, he would not hide them from his fellow men. And the moment an individual hides an action, he is telling you that he knows that it is wrong. Therefore, when we do anything of a quality which we would not wish others to know, I don't mean in the terms of normal privacy, but I mean in the terms of action for which we would feel shame or remorse, then we are performing an action that is not right. And if we are performing this action, we are setting up a chain reaction in nature. Paracelsus also went on to say that there are in this world, in this visible world in which we live, creatures around us and in nature whose constitution is different from what it appears to be. There are forms of life that are manifesting here which do not have their roots in the common life. He declared that there are human beings in the world, apparently, whose origin is different from that of some other persons. That in this world of things that all appear to be the same, there is more than one cause, more than one form of life, more than one type of being existing. Paracelsus points out that there are beings with us and around us who, like the elementals, are not of the flesh of Adam. And that for that reason, there are persons by whose origin a unique or peculiar destiny is inevitable. These persons may not know this themselves. But Paracelsus pointed out that in legends, that heroes or heroic beings are frequently born of the union of human and superhuman parents, that nearly always in the great world teachers and saviors and sages, there is a hint of a miraculous origin between human and non-human factors uniting to produce such persons, as in the simple case of Merlin the magician, who is said to have been the son of a mortal woman and a salamander. What the facts behind this story is, we do not say again. But Paracelsus was convinced, through his medical therapy and research, that there was more than one kind of human being, and that the plants that grow by the side of the road, some of those plants belong to this earth and some do not. But the study of these things would be of the greatest importance because perhaps of their remedial agency. He pointed out, for example, that we recognize the importance of various planets in the sense of the lives upon them and their possible interference or participation in our affairs. This is coming again with the thinking that is now in our public mind. Are other planets inhabited? Are there other worlds? Are there other dimensions from which flying saucers might come? We have all these problems that are worrying us a little at the moment. Paracelsus did the first worrying recorded to modern man on these subjects. He was concerned with them constantly, for he was convinced out of his own wanderings and his practice that this is not the simple world that we think it is, that there are many elements and factors in it which are incomprehensible to us, that we have no way of estimating, and that a great many so-called acausal factors are traceable to the invisible world around us. But this invisible world is full of life, full of light, full of beings, and that humans may, to some degree, respond to these beings, and that the legends that we have relating to contacts between mortals and immortals may have bearing upon dimensions which will open to us in the future. When these dimensions open to us, they will not appear to be supernatural in any way. There is nothing in the universe of Paracelsus, with all his thinking, that he would have acknowledged for a moment to be supernatural. He declared there could not be anything supernatural, because nature is in itself a law. but that there are a great many things which man in his ignorance considers miraculous or regards as supernatural because he has no available explanation for them. But that all unknown or concealed things, as they move into our understanding, become natural, become acceptable, and become practically matter of fact and everyday. But until we recognize them, until we know them, they seem miraculous and impossible. Now, there are several points of practical bearing to be derived from the Paracelsian concept of the nature spirit, which perhaps we should also consider. Man's present problem in life, his present physical problem, deals very gravely with biochemic factors. The problem of man's balancing the various energy fields with which he is at present concerned, becoming more vital all the time. Each year as it goes by finds medicine in its traditional form of therapy less and less suitable to the needs of the individual. The therapy which was sufficient for our ancestors, mostly bleeding, poulticing, and purging, is no longer suitable to us. The tremendous leaning upon chemical medicine, which has increased so powerfully with the rise of the great pharmaceutical houses, is also gradually moving away from us. We have declared rather emphatically and have proven to some degree that we have extended physical therapies in the form of materia medica into almost every field, and we have cures for almost everything which is conceivable to us. One or two desperate problems remain unsolved, but for the most part our pharmacopoeia can cope with almost anything. Yet we are not well. We are perhaps less well than ever before in history. And by degrees, our entire series of system of therapy is moving from a physical therapy to a borderline approach between the visible and the invisible parts of man. We're beginning to recognize, for example, that disease, for the most part, arises within man. We know and have known for a long time that the human being is a walking bacterial laboratory, that almost every ailment conceivable to man is already in him at all times. But that while the balance of his health is maintained, these negative circumstances do not accomplish any evil or ill. Man's sickness arises when he falls out of balance, when the harmonic relations between the energy centers are destroyed or disrupted. The moment there is unbalance, there is death. And this local death, if it is not handled quickly, spreads and becomes a general disease for that individual. Thus, our entire theory of therapy today is to keep the human mechanism in equilibrium, to maintain the constant motion of its energies, and to prevent the obstruction of these energies, recognizing in malnutrition and in physical ailments, particularly physical injury, common causes of obstruction, recognizing always that disease and obstruction move together. The problem is to keep man's system constantly open, keeping his energy fields free to move or send their supply of life without inhibition or limitation to any part of the body where this energy may be necessary. And it is necessary, of course, in one of its forms, or more than one, in all parts of the body. Thus we have the problem of what constitutes the gravest danger that can possibly confront man. The answer is debility. The moment debility is observed, the individual is open to everything. Debility will reduce his resistance to infection. It will reduce his resistance to negation. It makes it easier for him to complain, find fault, be discouraged, be bitter, antagonistic. Depletion destroys basic optimism because it destroys man's internal sense of security. The moment his sense of security is destroyed, he goes into a panic. The degree of the destruction, measuring, of course, the degree of the panic. Thus, debility is the great enemy. Now, man lives in a universe of life. Paracelsus describes this as a tremendous field in which man lives in life as the fish lives in the sea. It would be just as impossible to say that life fails man as it would to say that the sea fails the fish. It cannot be that man, by any circumstance, can be deprived of life by life. Any more than religiously, we may say, and Paracelsus held the idea, that any man could so hasten in any direction or so rapidly that he could in any conceivable or inconceivable time be nearer to or further away from God. That which is eternal, ever-present, without limitation or boundary, is accessible to all things at all times. Thus, life, per se, is available to man at all times. Life can never be separated from man. Man must separate himself from life. Life in itself is not a separable agent. It is a complete diffusion. It cannot withdraw any area of itself and leave a vacuum. It is therefore possible only that man, as Paracelsus points out, is deprived of life because he destroys the areas or fields within himself by means of which life is distributed through the structure which he calls his body. The human being is equipped with a kind of aerial, similar to that of a radio or television. This aerial gathers this energy, or receives it, and distributes it through the system. It is only after this energy reaches the aerial and begins its distribution that anything can happen to it. And the thing that can happen to it is that it can be blocked. It can be blocked superphysically or physically. It can be blocked mentally, emotionally, or materially. But unless it is blocked, it cannot fail. And in the human being, it is usually not totally blocked. But if any major element of it is blocked, you will have a major imbalance, loss of vitality, loss of function, or you will have the cause of the gradual rising of a particular ailment within what would otherwise be regarded as a healthy body. So Paracelsus tells us that energy moving in upon man is blocked in three levels. It is blocked mentally. It cannot be blocked spiritually because spirit cannot move against itself. It can be blocked only mentally, emotionally, or physically. It is mentally blocked if, for example, the individual, by his attitude, closes his mental field by mental tension, which locks the field. It is emotionally blocked by emotional tension, which locks the field. It is physically blocked by physical tension, which locks that field. Therefore, tension, mental, emotional, and physical, must precede the failure of bodily function. Mental tension, emotional tension, or physical tension are all of them the result of malfunction. Regardless of what we want to believe, or what we would like to affirm, or how we would like to protect our attitude, all tension is essentially bad. There is no such a thing as righteous indignation. There is no such a thing as a godly temper. There is no such a thing as a justifiable hate. We may have justifiable cause for certain reservations. We may feel that certain situations, because of what they are, cannot receive our approval. We may voluntarily decline to become involved in something we do not believe is right. Decision is permitted under any and all conditions, but tension is never permissible under any condition by nature. Therefore, tension, wherever it accompanies decision, precedes it or follows it, will destroy function. If the mental energy field is blocked by mental tension, by any one of the negative mental attitudes that we know, the flow of mental energy into the structure is restricted, resulting in mental fatigue, first evident in poor judgment and the inability of the individual to think clearly. Where a mind becomes confused, it is because tension has blocked its energy. Where the mind becomes tired, it is seldom because of thinking. We're not that good at it. What it generally means is that we are fatigued by confusion, and confusion is tension. In the emotional field, it is the same. Confusion is tension. Hate, grief, jealousy, envy, these emotional pressures create tension and lock the emotional agent. Wherever we lock the mental agent, according to Paracelsus, we lock the air content of the body. In other words, every mental attitude affects respiration. We know this is more or less provable, but Paracelsus goes further with it. He points out that the whole process of respiration, as we know it, is far more complicated than we see. It's not merely opening your mouth and swallowing air. It is not merely gasping for breath. Mental tension interrupts or disturbs the flow of the air currents and the energies which they carry. And this air factor is finally localized in every single cell of the body. Therefore, the pollution of the mental agent results in symbolic reaction downward into matter, in the pollution of the air field. So every time we have negative thinking or destructive thinking, we are setting up a private smog problem, which is going to pollute every bit of the respirational process of that body, loading it with toxins. The emotional element affects the fire content, and to some degree also the fluid content, but primarily the fire content. And wherever the emotional factor is unbalanced, we have too much or too little of the igneous principle in the body, resulting in your flushing, resulting in chills, resulting in all the upsets in the actual caloric balance of the chemical structure of the body. Interference or tension on a physical level disrupts the intake of chemical ether, which is the actual medium by which all nutrition is conveyed from the source of food to the functioning structure of body chemistry. Therefore, a destructive or unbalanced pressure striking into the physical organization disturbs man's ability to transform nutrition into available energy. So the moment tension arises in any of these three fields, we have disturbance. Nature has created a defense against disturbance. And this defense operates up to a certain point. But if the disturbance is too prolonged and is allowed to increase until the disturbance center, like a storm center, is greater than the ability of the body to compensate for, or greater than the ability of normal rhythm to defend itself against, then the inroads upon the constitution begin and the individual passes into a state of depletion. Whenever these things happen, we have, according to Paracelsus, the therapeutic introduction of elementals. Because the elementals, in part of their function, have to do with the regulation of the elements in the body. So Paracelsus points out that there are actually elementals functioning within the magnetic field of man, and that it is perfectly proper that they should be there, inasmuch as they are the custodians of energy. They must take care of the remedial procedures. Paracelsus pointed out that the elementals are largely the protectors of elements, and that wherever remedial procedure goes on in nature, wherever a wall that is torn down is apparently rebuilt by nature, all rebuilding is under the control of elementals. Therefore, without the assistance of these beings, nothing can be restored that has once been destroyed in structure. Just as man tearing down a wall must either rebuild it or it remains there. So when in biochemistry any elemental field is torn down or damaged, it is notable that we have what is called a recuperative procedure in nature. Nature fighting to build back. Nature isolating an infection. Nature encapsulating a tumor. Nature moving in to cause a bone to knit. If we could see these procedures in action, if we could slow down films or do something to watch these remedial processes as we can now watch the opening of a flower, for example, we would observe that nature moves in on this situation, not merely as a blind force, but as a highly intellectual and selective force, doing exactly the things necessary. We cannot assume, or at least Paracelsus did not dare to assume, and I think we would almost agree with him, that the one sovereign intellect of the universe could personally supervise the restoration of every cell in the composite body of all the kingdoms existing in nature. That these remedial processes must, therefore, be under sub-leadership or government. Just as no one man could take care of all the problems of humanity and is lucky if he can take care of his own. We also recognize that in the knitting of a bone, the human intelligence itself is not the source of the remedy. Man does not know any more about the knitting of a bone, actually, or how to cause it, than almost any other mystery of life. Any more than he would know exactly how to keep his own heart beating. He can tell how to stop it, but he does not know how to start it or keep it beating. In Paracelsian theory, therefore, everywhere in nature where intelligent processes are going on, they are made possible through elemental beings existing within these substances. Beings that have the same peculiar shrewdness or the same intuitive skill that the bee has in the creation of its world. or according to Paracelsus, the mystery of the ant and the bee and the beaver, the mystery of the squirrel storing up provisions. All of these mysteries go back to the nature spirits, just as the Greeks believed that the nature spirits were the guardians of the lesser kingdoms of life. Paracelsus said, yes, that is probably true. But also, by the same token, because all kingdoms of life are also in man, man has parts of his nature which are animal, parts that are vegetable, parts that are mineral. So man likewise, in his recuperative procedures in medicine, functions and works through the cooperation of intelligent beings that have the natural skill to repair disaster. Even the physician today will tell you that he can set a bone, but he cannot make it knit. And the knitting of the bone may be a very difficult procedure. He can sterilize the abrasion or clean out any poison that may be there. He can set it properly. He can examine it periodically. He can tell the possessor of the broken member certain things to do, which normally will increase the probability of knitting and make available more calcium and things of that nature. But he cannot make the bone knit. The human being who owns the bone cannot make it knit himself, but he can stop it from knitting. He can stop it from knitting by worry alone. He can stop it by fear. He can stop it by any emotion that reduces the availability of natural currents. A Paracelsus would say he can stop it by cutting off the elemental energy by which the elemental being is able to create its own elaborate lace-like mingling of minute strands and threads by which that bone gradually knits together. The process of knitting a bone, the bone knitting, is more marvelous and more wonderful than probably the most delicate experiment that man can make. And yet everywhere it reveals intelligence. Paracelsus did not believe that the bone itself was intelligent. But he believed that every living force or energy available to man and necessary to man's function was intelligent. And in the University of Paris, some years ago, a paper was read to prove or justify the idea that electricity existed in two forms, one of which was intelligent. And that therefore, you could reason with electricity. Certain phases of it are responsive to intellectual selectivity. Energy is the same way. And Paracelsus believed that energy operated in the production of its miracles simply because it was a field of life and of living things and of intelligent beings. And that these intelligent beings were the architects and administrators of energy. He therefore created within his elemental kingdoms, created races and numerous sub-races. He pointed, as we have said, to the fact that there were animals, plants, human beings, or their equivalents in these elements. And that these animals and plants in the elements had also their polarities in man. For there are structures in the human body dependent entirely upon fire. Others dependent entirely upon water. Others dependent upon a chemistry of fire and water. Each of these parts of man is nourished by its own energy counterpart in space. And man can sustain no organ, no function, and no power that he does not sustain through his participation in a total availability. Now, modern man thinks of this availability as one substance differentiated in man. Paracelsus said no, that it is not merely one substance. It is essentially one principle, but it has already been highly differentiated before it reaches man. Therefore, man is himself an image of its differentiation. It does not break up in man. It is because it has already broken up that it can produce man. For man already represents an orderly division of energies. And thousands of different structures, millions perhaps, have to exist in the energy field before the composite body we call man could have been created or devised. Man, if he were merely a funnel for the distribution of solar energy or stellar energy or cosmic energy, he would need to be no more than a riverbank through which these things could flow. But he is not. He is an infinite diversity which can only exist because energy has already been diversified before it reaches him. Therefore, it sustains not only him and his diversity, but an infinite number of other forms of diversity. Each of these diversified levels is intelligent. And being intelligent and being generative produces within itself beings of its own kind that become its agents. And these beings administer it just as we regard the hierarchs of ancient times as administering the solar power through the solar system. Thus Paracelsus tells us that it is very good for us to live in a perpetual respect for invisible light, to know that it exists, to attempt to understand it, to arbitrate with it, to rationalize with it. And I think perhaps one of the best examples of that is the story I tell about Luther Burbank, who was able, as he told me, to accomplish certain things with plants because he had sense enough to sit down and talk to them. Others had the same skill, but they did not get the results. Burbank said, "These people have forgotten that when you deal with a potato, you are not dealing with a humble spud. You are dealing with a living thing, with a soul. And until you find that out, the true kinship between man and the potato will not be established. A potato is a highly respectable form of life. And small plants that we hardly recognize have three sense perceptions for each of ours. The only reason we do not think they are conscious is because they talk. They do not talk. On the other hand, we talk all the time, and that does not prove that we are conscious." The world, then, to Paracelsus, was this tremendous sphere of life, with countless organizations moving, with man growing up in it as a composite dependent upon all phases of it for the maintenance and equilibrium of his existence. And man, most of all, has got to sign a treaty of peace with life. He's got to form strong treaties. He's got to create his own League of Nations, binding all of the elements of life that are necessary to him into a camaraderie of purposes, and not into a highly speculative, highly combative, highly competitive series of relationships. "Man can persuade life to do many things," said old Paracelsus, "but can force life to do nothing. Therefore, the physician is the persuader, the one who seeks to arbitrate, who seeks to understand, and who seeks to see that all the elements involved in the correction of the physical difficulty have been given due consideration, honorable understanding, and helpful cooperation." In these ways, not only do we realize health to be an organization of intelligence, but we realize that sickness is actually a sickness of these intelligent relationships. That sickness is not natural. That sickness is not actually an immortal principle. That sickness is that which breaks rules or is the result of the disobedience. In other words, sickness, like evil, is, so to say, the result of man falling away from nature. the fall of man being the fall into conceit, into departure from the reasonable, the rational, and the true. One of the ways to correct this is to suddenly realize that we live in a cooperative, universal commonwealth, that the food we eat, the air we breathe, the clothing we wear, taken from the plant or the animal, that all these things are a part of a great pageantry of life, that we are in debt to everything that makes us live, and that we meet that debt by the constructive use of the powers and faculties that we possess for the improvement of total life. Millions of lives are sacrificed every day that we may live. And if we wish to be healthy, we must have a conviction in ourselves that these who have died have not died in vain. Man lives upon life. Therefore, he owes the debt to life. This debt is to live well and to advance life in every way that he can. And man's peculiar power is to preside over this pattern of elements, to bring it into harmony, and through harmonious adjustments, to advance the total growth of life. Man is the gardener in the great field of vitality, and it is his privilege to keep the garden well. And if he keeps the garden, the wonderful things that grow in the garden will keep him. If he neglects the garden, these things change into weeds, and his own nutrition is lost. But instead of man being a creature fighting space and the unknown forever to survive, man is actually a living thing, living in a world of living things, a world which in its natural and proper order is his friend. These living things, his co-workers, their happiness, their normalcy, depending to a degree upon his, and his upon them. And by gradually assuming this position, Paracelsus believed that the individual developed a philosophy of health that was adequate and suitable for him. And we will take up the next phase of Paracelsus' philosophy next week.